Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to the Rock on Tours podcast. I am Guy Pratt.
And I'm Gary Kemp. And this week on the show, we're talking to a legendary guitarist, a producer, a member of Roxy Music, and a good friend, Phil Manzanera.
Nice to be here.
So I'm
your smiling faces.
I know you well, but I'm still thrilled that I know the bloke from Roxy Music and that wonderful inside sleeve from the album picture that had you with the fly glasses
with
on
the bug eyes
and the famous
and the
Firebird.
I had the Firebird.
Where did all those guitars come from?
I think the Hagstrom could have been Paul's. I can't remember. Bizarrely.
Paul Thompson.
The drummer.
What would he be doing?
Well, I'm not. I can't remember. I have to Google it to find out who owned what. Obviously, Eno's Snake guitar was his own Snake guitar, you know, which is about a tenor from somewhere in Shepherd's Bush. And the Les Paul was the John Porter's Les Paul, bass player, that I borrowed on a lot of, to use on a lot of the albums. Yeah.
And where did the Firebird come from? How did you find it?
The guy who designed it, Ray Dietrich, when Gibson were looking at the Fender Success and they wanted to compete, so they commissioned Ray Dietrich, who was a famous car designer who had built all those amazing Fins.
Not the Cadillacs.
The great Chevys.
It has a deco look to it, doesn't it?
And so he basically took one of those fins, if you can imagine, from worked it up into the Firebird. And back in the day, when the Melody Maker, which was one of the two music newspapers in the 60s, they had a ad section at the back, and people used to buy and sell guitars in there. And I saw one day it said Firebird guitar. I had no idea what a Firebird guitar was, and so I rang up and said, "That sounds good. Can I come around?" I went to this amazing house in Regent's Park. And it was the son of a very rich American guys who'd come over from Kalamazoo. And they had bought their young son a red Gibson Firebird, direct from the factory, custom made, because most of them are brown. Right. And he opened the door and he just like held the red Firebird. I said, "Oh, that's mine. Thank you." And the reason was I had bought a Hofner Galaxy, which was red. That's all I could afford in the early 60s. And so red guitar, and I thought something flashy, you know, for Roxy. But, you know, when I joined Roxy, actually, they wanted me to ditch my 335 and get a white Strat. So for the first album...
Who demanded that?
You know, their style... icons, you know, who were running the band.
Well, that's funny because back then, white Strat, I suppose, would be Hendrix, but otherwise, you think white Fenders, you kind of think the Beach Boys.
But it wasn't sort of Anthony Price who decided what guitar people had to play.
Probably, you know, he gave me the glass, he gave me the look, you know, so he probably did decide. But I thought it was a bit dull, you know, so I eventually got my red Firebird, and that's been my signature guitar, if you like.
It is your thing, yes.
Yeah.
And the
Can you play it sitting
well?
Down?
Can you play it sitting down?
Because this doesn't have a little... It doesn't have a shelf.
Well, it's better than a Flying V. That's all I can say.
Right.
Which is impossible to play sitting down.
Well, there's a sort of interesting thing about the way that guitar looks and what Roxy was sort of doing at that time, which was a kind of pop art meets Americana, was it? Which was interesting for, you know, bloke from Newcastle as well.
Well, at the time, it all has to be put in context, doesn't it? At the time... There was a famous films out, The Last Picture Show. There was a band called Shanana, like referencing the 50s. So there was a general acceptance of 50s kind of culture and fashion and stuff. And Roxy was a mixture of all these incredible things put together by lots of people, you know, to do with Roxy. Not only Anthony Price, who you mentioned, the designer, there was Wendy Dagworthy making clothes. There was Nick DeVille.
Nick DeVille, of course, who designed the look of
who
his
was
sleeves.
The art director, and of course a fellow student with Brian at Newcastle doing fine art under Richard Hamilton. So and great photographers and all young people who were in their sort of mid-20s who were going to be the next people who fashioned fashion and who fashioned style.
So Roxy was a kind of art collective, really, wasn't it?
It was.
A Bauhaus.
Yeah, a veritable Bauhaus.
Did you actually, I mean...
Bauhaus. Should have done that song, really.
did all this stuff come together, or did you actually sort of sit down around the table and go, right, this is what it's going to be, this is what the vision is, or did it just kind of organically?
To be fair, you know, I come from a very different place from all the others. I mean, didn't go to art school, you know, I was brought up in South America, a totally different culture, and I hit upon these guys. I answered an ad in the Melody Maker and found myself... You know, I knew about Roxy because they had sent in their demo tape to Richard Williams at the Melody Maker, and he had written up a nice thing. And I had sent in our school band, prog rock type thing, to Richard Williams. And
is that Quiet Sun?
Quiet Sun. And the best thing about that was that Richard said, the best thing about this band is the blurb that was sent in with it, because it was actually written by Ian McDonald, who became the editor of the NME eventually, who was the brother of the bass player in the band. So I came to a bunch of older people who'd been to university and had bank accounts and had a loan for the PA and all grown up and had cars, you know.
Where were you at that point when you say they were all grown up? What were you?
Well, I was 20, you know, and I...
Did you have a job or anything? Or?
I had a job for about 2 months as a temp for this... a travel company that was trying to recover like £2 million in debts, and all the people were temps, and they were making like sort of airplanes out of the invoices and things. And I had gone for an audition with Roxy and failed.
Wow.
I made friends with them. I used to bump into them all over the place. And then...
when you say all over the place, what were the hangs?
Well, at avant-garde concerts at the QEH, you know, like...
What, sort of Stockhausen?
Not Stockhausen, but Terry Riley all those kind of things. I'd bump into Eno and...
songs just in C.
Yes, in C was very popular then, yeah, and Rainbow and Curved Air.
Yeah.
And that album. And some friends of mine did the light show for them. They got a gig at the Friends of the Tate Christmas party. So I went along with my friend to see the light show, and this tranny pulled up. Actually, I've got to say...
Transit van.
Because it could have been a tranny if it had been a year later.
I thought was that Eno?
Yeah. Well, so it turned up, and Brian was driving it, and Andy
Brian
was,
driving a transit van, that.
Yeah, and Andy was
That's
in
your
the front
album
seat,
cover.
And Paul was stuffed in there somewhere, and Eno, being sort of not so tall, was sort of slotted in with the PA system in the back, and Dave O'List was there, who was by then the guitarist, and he was a fantastic guitarist, who was in, and probably still is, in the band called The Nice, who, you know, had done very well.
Which just started with Keith Emerson. Yeah, Five Bridges was sort of first prog rock album.
And anyway, the doors opened and they all were humping these Turner cabinets in. And I thought, wow, they don't have roadies. and poor chaps are having to bring the stuff in. So I'm sort of about to help. And I noticed that Dave wasn't helping because he'd been in a professional band before and he was just sitting there with a fag and watching them, you know.
Watching Brian Ferry.
Brian walking the gear in and everything. And so made contact again, you know, saying, would you come down and help mix the sound? Because in those days, Eno used to be in the audience mixing the sound.
Yeah.
Because he was a bit...
With a VS synthesizer or...?
With his synthesizer and the mixing desk. And I don't think they allowed him on stage because he made everyone too nervous. So, and also, moving on. And we haven't got all day here. And
Because they didn't want to get poked in the eye with an ostrich feather.
It was pre all that gear and wearing all those amazing outfits. And there were no amps on stage. So everything went DI'd into the mixing desk.
God, that's literally 50 years ahead of your time, because that's where we are now.
But yeah, conceptually, we were way ahead of our time, everyone going and being mixed by Eno. But of course, it was incredibly frustrating for people on stage because you were at the whim of what Brian Eno wanted to do with the mixer. So, you know, if you couldn't hear yourself, tough. So they asked me, he said, can you come and mix the sound? I said, well, I've got no idea how to mix the sound. He said, don't worry, Eno will teach you. So he went to...
And you'd already failed your first audition.
I'd failed the first audition, yeah. A terrible cold. And they wanted somebody famous to help launch the band. But then I used to see in the Melody Maker, Dave O'List's Roxy playing at the Friars Aylesbury or something. So it obviously, probably got to them. They say, hang on, this is not going to work. So I went round to this a friend of theirs' house, which was sort of a derelict house, but had some electricity in Notting Hill. And when I turned up, they said, oh, Dave hasn't turned up. His guitar's dead. Fancy having a go. But I had a sort of little premonition that something might be coming up. So I had learnt all this stuff the night before, because they'd done a John Peel show. I could hear, you know, what the songs were. I said, well, look, show me the chords or whatever. Thinking back on it now, there are only like two or three chords. And show me the chords and I'll play it. So I play it and I'll just play it like just totally right. Well, okay, next one. So, you know, they thought, Jesus, this guy actually is bloody good.
Were you imposing a style? Did you have a style of guitar playing?
No, I was actually sort of like copying a bit what they'd played already. So I knew, you know, I didn't want to scare the horses, as they say. So so I played that. And then they said, well, would you like to join? And so I joined on the... it was my birthday on the 31st of January. The 4th of February I joined, and the contract, Roxy contract, is signed on the 14th of February. And then 6 weeks later we're in the studio recording, and then 8 weeks later it was number four in the chart. 1972. So I just was in the right place at the right time. But how lucky were they?
Well, you did have an extraordinary sound. I mean, it's partly your style of playing, but also live, you went through Eno's... Did that go onto record, that sort of? Did Eno mess with your sound on record?
Oh, yeah, no. On the first album, Ladytron. The end of Ladytron is what we used to do live, which was basically I would have part of my signal would go to Eno, to his VCS3, and he had two Revoxes going for tapes and things. And I had a Revox going, which, this is very technical, we had modified by the same company that Floyd were using and all that, which is Taylor Hutchinson, who you could change it. I've still got it. Cell sync and vary pitch and all sorts of stuff. So you could mess around live on stage. And, you know, in those days, there weren't presets from Japan that you could just use. Or, you know, you had to be very analog and very BBC Radiophonics Workshop and actually do crazy things and stick nails in.
Was it tape? Was it like a Benson Ecorex? Or was it?
They're actual tape recorders. And then if you put sticky tape on the capstan, it creates a fluttery sound. And that was something that was quite used quite a lot in Roxy. And just basically, you know, Eno was also very good at creating sounds out of nothing when they hadn't invented samplers, they hadn't invented all these things. So it was being creative.
On that subject, like the 801 live album, right, which of course is one of the great inspirations for me, in fact, that version of Tomorrow Never Knows, that great Bill McCormack intro, the bass intro, is one of the first things that made me think, do you know what, the bass could be really interesting as an instrument and I might stick with
it. What, you mean you hadn't heard Jack Bruce?
No, but there was something about that that was interesting. But what always got me, because I remember you saying that, wasn't it, that there's all sorts of incredible sound effects and stuff that happen. And there's one particular one. And you said, wasn't it because Eno just had a tape of random effects running through the song?
Yes, yes. He would. I've still got the cassette tape, actually. It says it says a picture, and he's sort of written on it, birds or something. But there was a bit of a Radio 4 programme with some Judy Dench or somebody reading something. There were birds. There were all sorts of random stuff. Yeah, and he set it going at the beginning of the track, you know, when it starts out. And the things just came in randomly. And there was a bit of backwards echo and all sorts of stuff, which yeah, I mean, the whole of that was just...
There's just this one particular sound, which is so perfect. So you think, there's no way that's...
I know, it's just before the vocals come in, and it was total chance. Just by total fluke.
Yeah, so I guess in that sense, I mean, Floyd was a bit of an influence, was it really? Were there found sounds or...
Well, I suppose so. I mean, but we weren't thinking Floyd.
Going back to Astronomy Domini and the way that starts, you know.
Yeah. Well, obviously that's incredible. All that for me was, meat and potatoes. I mean, I loved all that, first week Floyd.
Because you met David when you just got the gig, didn't you, at some studio?
No, what happened, actually, when I was 15, my father died in South America. We moved back full time to London. My mother is a Colombian lady. And when I was 16, going on 17, I was getting free education at Dulwich College, which was very nice of them. They paid for all my education because my dad died. And I said, look, I will take A-levels and all that, but I don't want to go to uni. I want to become a professional rock musician. She said, hey, what's that? Could hardly speak English, but poor mum, Colombia.
What's that? Sorry.
And my brother, who's 8 years older than me, who'd been at Cambridge, said, look, I know this guy. He's just joined a band. He's a professional musician now. Let's go and talk to him. Ask him what you have to do to become a professional musician. So he arranged a lunch, and that person was David Gilmour. So, age 16, just about to go 17, we went and had lunch with him up in Earl's Court, near the flat that he was living in.
The Troubadour?
Opposite the block of flats where he used to live. He says he can't remember what he said. It must have been good because 5 years later I managed to join Roxy. But I do remember after the lunch we
pedals. Just get lots of pedals. Yeah. Loads of pedals.
They hadn't invented them.
I know.
We went back to his flat. He got his Strat, put it in his case, and off he went to Abbey Road. For that album.
Well, the
Sourceful of Secrets. Secrets, yeah. So we're talking like
67,
January. Yeah, that's right. So I met him then. So years later, when we were recording For Your Pleasure up at Air Studios here, when it was an Oxford Circus, we started recording in Studio 1. And in Studio 2, Chris Thomas was in there mixing Dark Side of the Moon. So, I popped down, had a listen, I thought, wow, this is incredible. So I sent David a telegram saying, remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music. And from then onwards, so from 1973 onwards, we've been in contact with Marine Friends and worked with him for a time.
But there's always been quite a funny Floyd. It's one of those odd bands that there are bands that are linked and they're not always necessarily the obvious ones. And there seems to me to have always been this sort of Floyd-Roxy connection.
What are the other connections?
Well, there's a great odd one I remember of... when David gave me as a wedding present this 1960s Stack Knob Fender jazz bass. And when I got asked to play for Roxy Music, I took it up for the first rehearsal. And it was at Phil's studio. And Phil said to me, I know that bass. And it turns out that David had actually got the bass from Rick Wills, who was his childhood friend, who'd been the bass player in his first band, who then played bass.
That's right, who I auditioned
for Roxy back in the early 70s. So I actually brought this bass back to Roxy Music after 30 years or something. Yeah.
And where is the bass? What is the bass?
I've got it home. It's very nice.
Oh, very
The other connection that you got.
Chris Thomas, of course.
That you don't know is that before I joined Roxy, I had this band called Quiet Sun and we were trying to make it, sending demo tapes and everything. And because we knew Robert Wyatt, me and Bill McCormick, and Robert knew Nick Mason, I actually had a telephone conversation with Nick asking whether he would be interested in producing Quiet Sun.
Wow.
But of course, Nick did produce Robert Wyatt.
He did produce Robert Wyatt. And actually, Bill McCormick from Quiet Sun played with Nick and Gary Window.
How was it playing with all those kind of, let's say egos? These are big people in there.
Yeah, but when you start, there aren't, you're like the 3, 4, 5 musketeers. It's all for one and one for all. And then eventually, you obviously start impaling each other.
You never really had a bass player, did you?
No, because unfortunately, Graham Simpson, who was Brian's friend from uni and was an incredible musician, fantastic musician.
He went a bit...
He had some mental problems just after we recorded the first album. So that and then we had a problem. We had to find someone to play bass. So then one reason or another, either we wanted to change bass players or we didn't, or they left because John Wetton, who's a fantastic bass player, would have liked to have him be a member, but he suddenly one day said, "I'm joining Uriah Heep. I'm off," because they're flying around in jets. And, you know, we're just about...
I was the 11th, I think.
Were you 11th? I think there's been 13.
I remember you saying 13 and out. And I actually, because I was in a Roxy documentary and I was asked what it was like playing bass for Roxy Music. And I said, well, put it this way, you don't want to take a mortgage out based on being Roxy Music's bass player.
But, you know, I remember seeing Virginia playing, you know, guys doing that on Top of the Pops.
And, a lot of people.
The next... You know, well, 2 days after, when it was Saturday, I went straight up, bought that record. Yeah. It made such an impression on me. The sound, I still, to this day, can't work out what instruments are playing what. It starts with this really incredibly quiet keyboard part, isn't it? A guitar part. And then suddenly the volume all comes on.
Well, yeah, it wasn't recorded for the first album. We didn't have a single. They said, where's the single?
This is the thing that's amazing is that when you've got an album and people saying, there isn't an obvious single, you need to go and do an obvious single. And you come back with Virginia Plain, a song that literally just says, "What's her name, Virginia Plain?" And that's the hook. Yeah. It's like,
tell us about
really?
It. it's amazing. So daring and out.
Yeah,
you know, at the time,
daring is the word. Yeah.
Well, at the time, it wasn't seen as being cool to have a single, so having a pop single. You know, we're talking about the Zeppelin days just coming just before us. And you know, Brian said, "Well, I've got this thing. It's got three chords. You know, so let's do it." And we had all loved Motown and all those great singles. And so I said, let's try and do a single that's under 3 minutes. So we had made a big point that it was only going to be 2 minutes, 52 seconds and try and get it all in. And it really does encapsulate everything about that early Roxy in 2 minutes and 52.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
Seconds, which is wonderful. The lyrics, the playing, the sounds. And it's incredibly simple. You know, it is just guitar, bass, drums, and Eno synth. And voice.
And
obviously saxophone.
Oh, yeah.
Silly me. And oboe. There's very few ingredients, and that's why it sounds great, is because it's big and fat and it just works, and it's analog
and the look
and all played together.
The glam look. I mean, because you toured with Bowie, didn't you? Bowie at the Rainbow, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we only played with him about twice or three times, but he was incredibly supportive and nice. And, you know, when I remember at rehearsals, Andy and Brian had been to see him, and I think that influenced a lot that we had to step up our game in terms of presentation. And in fact, we then got his lighting guy. And in those days, he was the first person to have these sort of scaffolding things on small stages with some actual theatre lights, and people didn't have that before. So
he had Mick Ronson up on a gantry somewhere, didn't he, on some scaffolding. The band were sort of
that's right. So and we had his guy, we used his guy, and so, you know, all those kind of cumulative things helped. And obviously then we upped our game with we're all a bit shy, so we said, let's just put on costumes as if you're in the theater or something like that, and become different people when you go on stage. So, you know, you turn up with sort of drab clothes and then suddenly in the dressing room. But it wasn't coordinated or anything like that. It was totally, everybody did their own thing, found their own people. And the first time we saw what we were each wearing was when we literally changed before going on stage. Really? And they said, you're not going to wear, what is that? You're wearing that? You know, to Eno or something.
Did you ever both be wearing the same? I can't go on stage. He's wearing the same snakeskin.
never.
Anthony Price then came along, didn't he? And he coordinated it.
Well, Wendy Dagworthy as well. You know, in those early days, because all the outfits on the second album cover were Wendy Dagworthy. Well, actually, no. Mine, Brian's, Eno's was done by Carol McNichol.
You talk about the centerfold.
Yeah, the centerfold. Yeah.
For your pleasure.
So it was, you know, a variation of lots of people making stuff. And it was just the juxtaposition of it all together that created a whole. And it's the same with the music. You know, it's everyone playing little bits and little bubbles coming. You know, the bubble coming out of my head was, I'm in the Velvet Underground and the early Pink Floyd. I'm playing this way. And I don't, whatever you're playing over there, this is what I'm playing.
Right,
you know,
this is almost like Eno's cards.
Yeah,
it?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. The oblique strategy.
It's like you drew the Pink Floyd one or whatever.
Well, the psychedelic 60s and Soft Machine and all that fuzzed up stuff.
Also, how easy was it getting Tomo into those outfits? Because knowing Paul, who's the most wonderful down to earth,
great drummer. What a drummer!
The great Paul Thompson.
Yeah, the great,
wonderful down to earth guy. And I was wondering when we go here, you're in this sort of leopard skin cat suit.
Yeah, I think it was challenging for him.
Exactly.
It was challenging for him. But you know, to give him total credit, you know, he was the person who kept it all together. You know, because if you hadn't had that guy whose hero was John Bonham playing, it would have been all over the place. And that gave us our rock sort of basis, you know.
Andy Newmark tells this great story that he was staying in Blake's or whatever, some London hotel, and John Bonham came in and he heard, they said, oh, Roxy Music's drummer is here.
Yeah.
And there was this banging on the door, and Andy opened the door and John Bonham grabbed him and threw him up against the wall and went, you're not Paul Thompson.
Oh, really?
And of course, Andy Newmark was one of the great drummers as well. Well,
exactly.
Young
yes.
Americans.
Yeah.
Well, and Lennon's album.
Yeah, and the rest.
Yeah, 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 everything. Yeah. Sly and the Family Stone.
Right. When Eno left.
Yeah.
I mean, it's to be honest, it's a little bit, because it was shocking at the time as a punter, me as a fan.
And
I thought, even though Brian wrote all the songs, you know, you saw Eno as some sort of mastermind, you know, a bit like the guy in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know.
Frankenfurter.
Yeah. And yet, a bit like Genesis when Peter left, and then they went on to become world famous. Mm. The same sort of thing happened to Roxy, really, didn't it? Because your biggest selling part of your career was post Eno and going into the 80s.
Well, Brian always said, well, I like is that Eno says that his favourite album is the third one, is the one after he left.
That's right. Yeah, that's very Eno.
I know, that's very Eno.
That's very Eno.
Oblique.
Yeah, oblique. But, it was, you know, I was very friendly and we were sharing an apartment, a flat at the time. So it was quite traumatic that
he
left.
Why did he leave?
For lots of reasons.
Yeah. One of them, I like the fact, wasn't it, he said he was on stage and thinking about his washing.
Oh, yeah. When you find yourself on stage thinking about your washing, you know it's time to leave the band. I have felt that a few times.
I remember that when we go on tour this year.
Well, we are in our own shirts.
We do. I think about your washing room on stage.
I think about your smalls.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah. I'm not coming to see you guys.
No, go on. Well, you know, let's carry on. Eno leaves, and
Eno leaves, but obviously I don't leave working with Eno. So, you know, I continue working with Eno in parallel with Roxy.
You play on solo records
for the next 4 years. So
that must have been so great because you had 801, you had Roxy. I mean, it must have been amazing having you must so sort of creatively sated.
Well, actually, that period, I don't know how we all fitted in so much stuff. There were solo albums. There were projects.
Brian's having smash hit solo records.
Brian's doing, you know, the album that's just come out at the Albert Hall, which I didn't realise I played on. I played on with an orchestra in 1974. It's just come out.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's... Yeah,
sounds absolutely terrific, you know.
And you played on that?
And I played on that. Yeah, he said to me, oh, yeah, it's coming out, you know, and you're on it. I said... No, surely I only came off one number. No, you're on the whole thing. Really? I had no recall of it at all. It sounds absolutely terrific.
Is there another guitar? Is it Spedding as well?
No, it's John Porter.
Wow.
Because John Wetton played bass on it.
Oh.
No, and John Porter, incredible guitarist.
This podcast comes with a glossary.
Yeah.
And an index.
No, there's too many
John
things.
John Wetton, look it all up. It's all out
the
there
Sunshine
somewhere.
Boy then. No, that was Arnie Shekelstein. Arnie Shekelberg was it?
No, but Andy did a solo album. Brian did loads of solo albums. You know, I eventually...
Andy did solo? Oh, no, that Andy, was later, wasn't it?
No.
Well, he did Rock Follies.
No, he did... Well, he did that when I was doing 801. But he had done his first solo album, Resolving Contradictions.
Of course, Eno plays on 801 with you.
Yeah,
you
know, and I played on it all.
Well,
Eno's
you had
album,
a nice I, point of... I remember you saying to me about how the point of 801, wasn't it, was the idea, was it was kind of like, it was a band of two parts and it had these absolute uber musos.
It was meant to be an experiment between musicians and non-musicians. So we chose three non-musicians.
The lady doth protest too much.
Yeah. And... me in the middle as sort of referee. And it was only designed to last 6 weeks. It was meant to play three gigs, only played two. Recorded one of them, and that album is what
came out. You see, the way you just described that sounds so much like an actual art project, doesn't it? Right, we can do this thing. It's going to be 6 weeks. Yeah. That really is art.
You set the boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, what it occurs to me is that everything was done very quickly. Which kind of, everything started to slow down as we went into the 80s and later on, where people would take 4 years to make an album. Mm. You must have been recording really fast and Brian must have been writing very quickly as well.
Absolutely, and going on tour immediately and not finishing the album, having to drive back from the gigs, you know, every night to try and finish the album and then go back to the gigs. So... Yeah, I mean, it was quite a
prolific.
It was very prolific. And, you know, in those days, really, I think technology has changed everything. Because once you start getting more and more tracks that you can play with, and you spend more and more time in the studio. And
less in a rehearsal room.
Yeah, and by the time, you know, we got to Avalon, you know, we were recording at my studio. I had my own studio. And we were using the studio as an instrument. So it moved on from actually playing in the conventional way of doing backing tracks and then just overdubbing your bits and mixing it to... And by that time, we'd done Avalon's album number 8 and you wanted to do something different every time. So how do you do something different? You change your method of working. And it's a risk. And Avalon occurred because of that. You know, all sorts of things.
You once said to me... because for some reason I always thought it was Brian who'd coined this phrase, but you said it was actually this idea of using the studio as an instrument kind of came from 10cc.
It did come from because when I started building my studio in 1977 or something, I was doing it with Kevin Godley and Lowell Cream, and they had their studio up in Manchester, Strawberry Studios, and they had been using. Yeah, because the way, as I said before, there weren't preset sounds you could just buy or sampling or something. So you use whatever you could in the studio. Use the desk to use the faders up and down. Or they, as they invented new bits of studio gear, you were able to do this thing called triggering, which was using a gate, and then using that in conjunction with faders, and you created things, AMS. And you slowed down tapes.
Yeah. ADT.
ADT, and obviously they multi-tracked, I'm Not in Love and all that, hundreds of voices and stuff like that. So, there was a bit of, I was working with them before, in 1976 or 70. We formed a band with
another Godley. Band? How many bands do you want?
Godley and Cream, yeah. And
you were you played with them?
Yeah, and I recorded an album.
You turned to Appendix 3 subsection.
Yeah, we need one of, is it Pete Frame?
Exactly.
Pete Frame's rock and roll, rock family tree.
Yeah, the Roxy family tree would be a book in itself.
Well, when we stopped working together after the Siren Tour in 1975, 76, and Brian went off to do
what was the decision
celebrity.
On that, by the way?
There was no decision.
Was just like we all hate each other?
There was no decision. You know, with Roxy, there's no plan or nothing. Everyone just goes off and does things, and then randomly things happen.
No one phones you.
No one phones anyone and say, oh, well, it's not around. Okay, better do something else. So I was living next door to Kevin Godley. Let's do something. We got a deal. We had GCM, very Godley, Cream and Manzanera, started recording and everything. And then one day Brian rang up and said, can we get Roxy back together again? I said, well, I'm just in another band. And don't worry, you could do both at the same time. I said, oh, okay, well, I'll do that then. So, but then we decided to go and record Roxy in New York. So we actually couldn't do it.
So you had to extract the M.
Yeah, yeah. So M disappeared and it became the Godley and Cream album.
Let's have a bit more of your moving into your guitar playing with David again. I mean, and how that sort of started. Did David call you and think, hey, you're the kid I once had tea with. Can I get you in my band?
No, we saw each other. You know, and I actually ended up co-writing a track on Momentary Lapse of Reason.
Of course, so you had another connection.
So he used to come, when I had the studio and church, he used to come at Christmas. I used to have a Christmas sing-song, carols, and stuff. He used to come with the family. So I used to see him every year. And then I once went up to Super Bear in France when they were recording The Wall. So I'd kept in touch over the years as a friend. And then by some quirk of fate, ended up living next door to him out in the country. And so we saw more of each other. And then he hadn't recorded anything for quite some time. And he said, fancy, you know, having a listen to some stuff. And that's how it started. And so, you know, over a period of 10 years.
So you were listening to demos that he had?
Yeah. And bits and pieces. And then over a period of 10 years, you know, we did the first one, which was
on an island.
Yeah. Then we went on tour, didn't we, Guy? Yeah. And we did Live in Gdansk, which was the live album that came out. And then I
remember that night.
Yeah. But, that's right, remember that night. And then we did, I think in between, I did the Endless River, which is David, that Pink Floyd thing. And then the last one, Rattle That Knot.
Yeah.
And that was like suddenly 10 years had gone by.
And do you think being a guitarist is why David used us as a producer? That you
could, no.
And how do you advise what he plays?
No, you have to make sure that if you're coming up with ideas, you don't come up with any guitar ideas for a start.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, my job was like a facilitator, you know, to try and help somebody as a producer. That's what I do. It's not about me, it's about them. So I would look at things and say, you could put this together with that if you want to. And actually, I'll go to my studio and I'll do
it. You mean that little bit of demo?
Yeah. So I would go and do that. And then he'd say, what's that? I said, well, actually, that's what you played.
Because the funny thing, isn't it, is it seems to me there's a thing, practically all of David's songs, right, in the last album terms, all have at least one component which is recorded sort of on some really unusual thing, in a way. It's either, for instance, the SNCF jingle, which he recorded on his phone, or there's a bit of piano that was recorded on a mini disc in 2002, but it has to be that one.
It can't be replaced.
Or there'll be something that was on a wax disc from, but it's true, there's always one component, which is a really unusual, weird thing that he recorded, and you have to keep that moment.
That's somehow. Right.
But, so you grab it all and put it all into a computer? And
I listen to hundreds of little bits, and say, maybe bit number 84 could go with bit number 17. And then you could, or if you wanted to, you could put bit number 102 at the end. And I'll show you how you could do it. This is what it would sound like.
And these bits include vocal melody?
No, not all of them. Right. But some of them have, yeah, they have some scatting. It's a bit like being creative. You have to think, how could this work? You know, what kind of... So, you know, I would apply the sort of Roxy principle of the context, the sound context. What kind of context? What kind of visual soundscape does this evoke? Right. And try and put a little hint of that in and see whether he would respond to that and take it, you know, take it up and take it further and do what he's meant to do because it's his album.
Because I do know a couple of sneaky little things that you have done with it because it's... Because one of the challenges is that nothing's ever slow enough for David, is it? He's very unusual in that regard. He's the only guitarist I've ever known who just wants to always slow things down. Frankly, we'd still be finishing Comfortably Numb at the Albert Hall if it was up to him.
Well, Floyd time. Well, Robert White used to call...
And so were you connecting that with something that Phil had done?
Well, no, Phil was quite... Yeah, because things would sort of suddenly be a bit faster.
Yeah.
I've always, you know, my Latin side comes out and I love rhythm. And so even with Roxy, I say, can we just get going a bit more, you know?
Let's move on to that just a bit because that is so important to you. You know, you grew up in South, various parts of South America.
Cuba, Venezuela.
Colombia.
Colombia.
Why?
Hawaii.
What happened?
When I was...
You were on the run?
I was on the run, actually. Especially out of Cuba after the revolution. When I was six, my dad was posted to Havana. And so we're talking 1957. So, you know, if you've been to Cuba, haven't you?
Yeah.
I mean, the rhythms, you know, it all comes from Africa. So it's to do with religion as well, Santeria. It's about dancing. And then in Cuba, you also get the classical influence. So you get a very, the most musical island in the whole Caribbean. And, you know, if as a child you're taken to the Tropicana Club and you hear this amazing music, you know, and all these people who were at their prime when I was taken there as a child, Celia Cruz and all these people.
Oh, wow.
So and my mother being sat from Colombia, from Barranquilla, which is the Caribbean coast where cumbia comes from, and she was always dancing, always singing. And, you know, she started having guitar lessons, so she started teaching me how to play some Cuban songs and South American-y songs that, you know, I know off by heart. And it's part of the Latin culture, really. And so that was my background. And then I started listening to England on the World Service on the radio and said to my parents, send me to London. I want to go to London, you know, because there were some English boys who came out of South America who were at boarding school here and showed me some Chuck Berry riffs and things like that. I said, wow, this is
so hang on,
cool.
Prog rock, Quiet Sun, and that does. Yeah. You couldn't get further away, could
no.
you?
No. Well, that's because
straight
when I went
up middle class English rock music.
When I went to Dulwich in South London and Bill McCormick knew Robert Wyatt, and used to see him like after school on his way back home every night.
Soft Machine were huge.
So that was incredibly influential, you know, of experimental rock and psychedelia. It was all happening. And improvisation. It was all about improvisation. And that was the time in the 60s when the Grateful Dead and people like that would just play one riff and then play for half an hour, whatever, and then come back to the riff at the end, you know, and Cream and all those bits, sort of people.
Well, Interstellar Overdrive is...
Well, yeah, Interstellar Overdrive, yeah. So conditioned by all that. So my South American-iness didn't come out till I went back to that at the end of the 80s and started working with South American music.
Yeah, but Avalon still has a little bit of that going on, doesn't
it? Well, the actual track Avalon does, yeah.
No, true enough. Because you produce a lot of South American bands, don't you?
A lot of rock en español, as they call it. Yeah. Because I speak Spanish, I understand the words. And at one point, at the beginning of the 90s, I was unbelievably the only British or American producer who could produce and in Spanish, you know, who understood what the people were singing about and had the expertise, which I'd learned from Chris Thomas and the George Martin and the Air School of Recording, of how to record albums. So I became, by default, the number one producer of rock en español. And many of the artists that I produce have gone on and are now huge in America, in South America, in Spain. They're like the Bowie of South America, the Annie Lennox of South America. And they're ended up producing what have become like absolutely classic rock albums en español.
I've never ever heard a song in Spanish that does not have the word corazón in it. It does seem to be.
What does that mean?
It means heart. But I've literally never heard the word corazón.
I don't think I've ever
always come up somewhere.
Song.
In fact, the ones when I worked in Cuba with Cuban musicians, I wrote a song in Spanish, and I just said, I don't care what it says, but it obviously has to have the word corazón in it. And the person translating the lyrics said, "Yeah, sure, fine." Even when the Clash had one little Spanish bit.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Which they learned from. I think it was from Mick Jones's Cleaner.
Yeah.
And Spanish Bombs. Joe sings like a stanza of Spanish, and it's got corazón in it.
Really. Corazón doesn't really work for me. It sounds like a toilet cleaner.
Oh, but it does work for me.
Spotless. We're running out of time.
Yeah, yeah.
We have run out of time.
Good.
But we'll spend the rest of our lives talking together. But as far as you people out there are concerned, this is it with Phil Manzanera and this episode of Rock on Tours.
And if you have a question for a guest or for myself and Gary, then don't forget you can get in touch with us by emailing guyandgary@thepodcastworks.com.
Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
All the best.
That was great.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.